This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our society places a value on our height, but we'll talk to a writer who makes the case that there's never been a better time to be short. Now, the U.S. announced it would send 31 M1 Abrams tanks overseas to help Ukraine in its fight against Russia. President Biden talked about the tanks earlier today.
We'll begin to train the Ukrainian troops on these issues of sustainment, logistics, and maintenance as soon as possible. I'm grateful to Chancellor Scholz for providing German Leopard 2 tanks and will lead an effort to organize a European contribution of 2 tank battalions for Ukraine. I want to thank the Chancellor for his leadership and his steadfast commitment to our collective efforts to support Ukraine. Germany has really stepped up.
As Biden said, Germany will also send over tanks supporting Ukraine with 14 Leopard 2 tanks, and Germany will allow other nations to send their inventory of the German-made tanks to Ukraine, as Poland has already said it will do. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the U.S. sending these tanks to Ukraine and more generally U.S. and European support for the Ukrainian resistance to the Russian invasion? Do you have questions about the latest there? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Yoshiko Herrera is a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Yoshiko, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
This story turned over the last day and a half or so. When we first called you, it seemed like an open question of whether these tanks, German and American, would be going to Ukraine. What was the stumbling block? Why was this such a big open question given past military support for Ukraine?
Yeah, well, last Friday, there was a meeting of NATO and NATO partnered countries, and this was a big issue, a big contentious debate. And Germany really was the stumbling block because Germany supplies its Leopard tanks to other European countries, including Poland. Those countries wanted to send them to Ukraine, and Germany was suggesting that it wouldn't allow that. And it didn't suggest that it was going to change its mind very quickly on Friday. But the U.S. pressure seems to have been a key reason, I think, for why Germany changed its mind. And I think the decision by the United States is in part to gain cooperation from Germany.
One of the big questions with all kinds of military hardware over the last year or so has been, is this crossing a line that's going to provoke a strong reaction from Russia and from Putin targeting not just Ukraine, but something beyond that? What do you think it took to overcome that concern?
Well, I think that this has been maybe one of the guiding questions of the war is where is the line? What does it mean to, how can we avoid a direct NATO or US-Russia confrontation? And so each of these moments where there's a decision about sending weapons has kind of addressed that. Is this going too far? And I think the Russian response by now is somewhat predictable, which is that they say whatever weaponry is going to be sent won't make a difference, it won't work, and also the Ukrainian people will pay a price. But they've been making Ukrainian people pay a price with the bombing of civilian targets and apartment buildings, etc., regardless of the weaponry that's been sent. So I think that at this point, the nuclear threat and the threat of escalation to civilians, they've already crossed that bridge, and so I don't think that's effective anymore, and that's probably changed some minds in the West about what we can do for Ukraine.
With the American Abrams tanks, it's going to be a while to get the hardware there, get people trained on them. The Leopard 2 tanks are also going to take, they're a little closer at hand, still take a while to get there. Do you see an immediate symbolic value for Ukraine with this commitment?
Oh, yes. I think symbolically it's really important because it was a test of European and NATO unity. And there was, you know, unfortunately, disagreement that was on display last week. But the resolution of this shows that the United States and Europe is united in supporting Ukraine. So I think the Abrams tanks aren't probably going to be there for 6 to 8 months at least. Is what I've seen estimates of, but still it's an important commitment to say that the U.S. is supporting Ukraine as well as other countries. I mean, Germany is a very, very key player in the alliance supporting Ukraine. And so I think the agreement by Germany eventually, finally, is important, even though it took a while to get there.
During Biden's speech today, he commented on at least Russian Express concerns that this was an offense to Russia and raised the risk of offensive action to Russia with these tanks being in place in Ukraine. Here's another listen to President Biden.
There is no offensive threat to Russia. If Russia troops return to Russia, they'll be there where they belong. This war would be over today.
Now, I think a pro-Russian argument would be that Crimea is part of Russia now, that key eastern parts of Ukraine are part of Russia. Their claim is that they're defending their territory. I don't think that's recognized by pretty much anyone in the global community. How big a threat are these to the Russian occupation of parts of Ukraine?
Well, I think the hope is that in response to an expected renewed Russian assault in the spring, that these tanks are going to allow Ukraine to defend itself and to defend its territory. I mean, as you said, nobody outside of Russia really accepts the annexations or accepts that Russia, that the territory that they're fighting on is Russia. I think it's clear to most people that Russia invaded Ukraine. They're fighting on the territory of Ukraine, and Ukraine is trying to protect and regain its own territory. So I think President Biden is correct that Putin has the ability to end this war immediately by withdrawing Russian troops back into Russia, and that none of this hardware, none of this military support poses any threat to Russia per se, but rather it's aimed at supporting Ukraine and Ukraine's existential struggle to preserve its nationhood and statehood.
Talking to Yoshiko Herrera, professor of political science at UW-Madison, looking at the latest in the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the decision now by the U.S. and Germany to supply key battle tanks to the Ukrainian military. You can join in with your reactions, your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Jeff is with us in Superior. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good afternoon. I have very strong this. I think this is a ball of tangled haywire. I think it's a no-win situation, and escalating military weaponry only escalates the conflict. I don't defend what Putin is doing. I think he's held in power by the oligarchs. If Putin pulls out of Ukraine, he will lose power in Russia. Ukraine is corrupt. I think that's proven by the change of administrators they had in their government recently. I firmly believe, this is my opinion, that Ukraine belongs to Russia. It has been for centuries, and I think Zelensky should surrender. I know it's not popular, but that's my opinion. We should be negotiating peace instead of escalating war.
Jeff, thanks for the call. I think many people in Ukraine would disagree with the assessment that Ukraine belongs to Russia, but that's one of the key issues at stake here, Yoshiko.
Yeah, I think that one of the problems with the idea of Ukraine surrendering in order to get peace is that we've actually seen what has happened in Russian-controlled territory. And what's happened there is not peace. We see brutality and human rights abuses, some would argue rising to the level of genocide. And so for Ukraine to withdraw its military would mean to subject the people who are living in those occupied territories to this terror of the Russian state. And I think that's a real problem with the argument that Ukraine can just give up the territory and that will lead to peace. Unfortunately, Russia is not interested in peace, even in the territories that it's occupying.
Thanks for the call, Jeff, at 800-642-1234. Jeff, also referring to another piece of news there. President Zelensky, removed or encouraged the removal from office of some local administrators accused of corruption in Ukraine. Is that something you have your eye on, Yoshiko?
Yes, that's a big story. And potentially there could be more shakeups or changes in Zelensky's cabinet. So I do want to acknowledge that corruption is something that Ukraine has struggled with in the past. It's one of the reasons for the two successful social revolutions and turnovers in government in the past, that people were profoundly disappointed in their governments and fed up with the corruption. So corruption has been an issue that Zelensky has been working on. But it's kind of an interesting question to think about. What does it mean to fire somebody on the basis of corruption allegations? Does that mean that that's a signal that the country is corrupt? Or does that mean it's a signal that the government is doing something about it? So Zelensky is definitely suggesting it's the latter, that yes, there are some problems and he's addressing them. So I guess you can look at it different ways.
And when I see, Yoshiko, measures of corruption in nations around the world, Ukraine ranks pretty high in terms of corruption. Worse still, though, is Russia. And so on a global scale, we're choosing in some cases between a corrupt, very corrupt authoritarian regime in Russia or a fairly corrupt but still roughly democratic regime in Ukraine. Am I oversimplifying there?
I think that it's correct that Russia ranks worse on international indices than Ukraine in corruption. But I think the important thing is that Ukraine has changed very much since 2019, since the election of Zelensky. And those indices take a bit of time to catch up. And just when we might have expected additional surveys or rounds of research to assess the situation, just a couple of years after Zelensky's presidency, Russia has invaded. And so there isn't a lot of, it's not easy at this point to assess the level of corruption in a wartime state. So I think that there are many signs that suggest Zelensky's taking corruption seriously and trying to do something about it. But I don't think at this point it's very easy for either Russia or Ukraine to assess the level of corruption, because both countries are relatively difficult to access in terms of social science research at this point.
We're talking to Yoshiko Herrera, professor of political science at UW-Madison, about the latest in the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the U.S. and Germany announcing they'll send some key tanks to Ukraine. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the U.S. involvement with the war in Ukraine? Do you want to see more support, less support, military aid, financial aid, you name it? Call in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Yoshiko Herrera, professor of political science at UW-Madison, about the war in Ukraine, the U.S. announcement of the sending of military tanks to Ukraine, Germany also joining in on that. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on U.S. support for Ukraine, your questions about what's going on there. 800-642-1234 is the number. Back to your calls now. Tim is with us in Hollandale. Tim, hi.
To the caller earlier, for one, Ukraine's never been part of Russia, although Russia's tried to take it over the centuries and have done some obscenely cruel things to those people. Two, France helped us and fight for independence, and they went broke doing it. And if they had not done it, we would not be America. And the English certainly said a lot of bad things about us, so just comment.
Tim, thanks for the call. Yoshiko, Tim, getting to some fundamental questions here. What obligations, if any, does the U.S. have to help a country in a situation like Ukraine's?
Yeah, I think that it's becoming increasingly clear that Russia didn't just invade a country. Russia is attempting to change the European security infrastructure and really the global world order. I think that that's why many people see this not just as a matter of defending Ukraine, but of standing up for really civilization and democracy and norms of democracy and norms of human rights. To let Russia behave the way it's been in terms of the atrocities, the civilian bombing, et cetera, is really to step back from a lot of values that Americans have been fighting for over the years. So I think that there's many people that see it as both an obligation to support Ukraine against an aggressive neighbor, but also to just stand up for what's right in the world. And I think that latter argument is gaining steam the worse the Russian behavior has been as the war has dragged on.
Tim, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. The question of how this all ends, Yoshiko, the idea, and we've talked about this a little already, that Ukraine would give up parts of its territory and expose the people in those territories to what would happen under Russian rule, seems to be off the table largely. What would have to happen in Russia for them to pull back this invasion?
Well, yeah, unfortunately, both sides are committed to fighting at this point. Unfortunately, on the Russian side, no matter how bad its army has performed, no matter how bad the situation, they seem to have doubled down and are more committed to continuing the fight. Unfortunately, it looks like Russia is, you know, fortifying this line of conflict of more than 600 miles, and they are really digging in and planning for renewed assault in the spring. And that's one of the reasons why the additional weaponry and high-tech weaponry and the tanks in particular are important to Ukraine. But I think a number of analysts don't see a quick end to this. But it doesn't look to me like Russia is going to accept, they're not going to voluntarily withdraw or just sort of change their mind. They're going to have to be defeated militarily or pushed back militarily. And that's why the support for Ukraine at this point, the military support for Ukraine has become so important. It's possible if there was something radical in Russia, such as somehow if Putin were to die or something like that, that could bring about a change in policy. But the prospects for a coup or Putin stepping down, I think, are remote. Basically zero. I don't see any way that Putin is going to step down.
To the extent we gauge public opinion in Russia, it seems like, at least what we see here in the United States, most of the criticism of the war, the Russian war in Ukraine, isn't that it happened in the first place, but that it was mismanaged or run ineffectively. In effect, absent Putin, we might get a replacement that is even more militaristic in some ways. Is that a concern you have?
Not really. I think that Putin is basically behaving as badly as you can imagine. He's ruined Russia as a country for decades to come. He's ruined the economy. He's made it, he's isolated it internationally, and he's caused all this death and destruction in Ukraine. So I think when people worry about somebody worse than Putin, you think, what exactly would be worse? I think he's pretty far up there in terms of worst regimes, not only for Ukraine, but for Russia as well. But it's correct that a lot of the criticism is oriented towards criticism of how the war is being fought rather than criticism of the war itself. However, I think we have to always remember that Putin is illegitimate and he's not gained any supporters during this war. There were already a lot of people who were not supportive of him before the war, and those people are absolutely silenced and marginalized. So it's hard to know the true level of support within the country, because the only people really able to speak are people who are already regime supporters.
Talking to Yoshiko Herrera from UW-Madison, political scientist looking at the latest news in the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Yoshiko, I think something nagging on the minds of people around the world is, if Putin feels like conventional military victory is out of reach, if his troops are getting pushed back toward Russian borders, is there a situation where he resorts to nuclear weapons, locally at a tactical level or more? What do you watch for?
Yeah, this is a concern, and I think this has been a guiding concern of NATO's action and the United States' reaction to the war to avoid nuclear confrontation and avoid a direct NATO confrontation with Russia at all costs. I think what people look for, though, because of the number of times that this has kind of come up and Russia has raised this flag, is they look for actual movement of nuclear weapons and delivery vehicles to see, has anything actually changed in Russia's nuclear stance? Are they actually getting ready for some kind of nuclear attack? And whereas there were some indications at various points in the war that maybe this was more of a possibility. I think that there's been a lot of pulling back from that nuclear rhetoric. And even in this case with the tanks, they haven't directly threatened nuclear retaliation. They've said, Dmitry Peskov, the press secretary, said, well, these tanks won't work, won't be helpful, and Ukrainian people will suffer. So I think that that's an indication that they aren't actually actively focused on the nuclear response at this point. But it remains a concern because it's a regime that is not committed to any kind of humanity or human rights or norms of decency. So it remains a concern.
In just our last minute or so, Yoshiko, what are you watching for in the next couple of months?
Well, I think that it seems like we need to understand what ways the Ukrainians might be able to break through this line and make some additional progress. I'm sure that's what they're working on. On the Russian side, there's been a lot of turnover in military command. There's remains a ton of corruption. And so it's possible that despite their efforts to improve their performance, they won't be able to. So I think that people are going to be watching the performance on the Russian side and looking for options for the Ukrainian side, but also ways to make use of this additional new weaponry.
Yoshiko, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was Yoshiko Herrera, political science professor at UW-Madison. She joined us to talk about the U.S. decision to send tanks to Ukraine and that country's fight against Russia. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, you may have seen headlines and stories about machine learning, artificial intelligence, and chatbots that can write stuff that sounds maybe like it was written by a human. Well, there's a lot behind that. We're going to find out how those technologies work, what they can and can't do, and maybe answer your unanswered questions. If you have a question, email ideas@WPR.org. Then listen in tomorrow morning at 8. That's here on the Ideas Network. We are proud of our state parks in Wisconsin with good reason, and now one of them is getting some national recognition. A website called Travel Lens analyzed social media, online reviews, and more to rate state parks around the country. One category was most shared on Instagram. A Wisconsin state park came in 5th in the country among all state parks. Which Wisconsin park? The answer may shock you. Okay, not really. It was Devil's Lake, Wisconsin's most popular, most visited state park. Devil's Lake also shows up at number 14 among the most beautiful state parks in the country, at least according to online reviews. Number one on that list, by the way, just across the border, Porcupine Mountain State Park in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. By the way, the number one most Instagram state park was some sideshow in New York called Niagara Falls State Park. What? What are people taking pictures of there? No clue. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we take a look at a new kind of buy now, pay later financing, why it's happening, and some possible downsides. Now, how tall are you? A lot of people think a lot about their height. Many wish they could be taller. Pop culture and society tells us that taller is better, but our next guest says that notion is outdated if it ever was true in the first place. She wrote a column for the New York Times that says there has never been a better time to be short. Mara Altman is a writer and author. Her most recent book is called Gross Anatomy, Dispatches from the Front and Back. Mara, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, this is an interesting topic for you. You're right, because you are on the short side of the spectrum yourself. Can you talk a little bit about your own height and how it's been a part of your life?
Yeah, so I'm 5 feet, and I've always been on the shorter side. I was so short, I guess, in, you know, elementary school, junior high, that my parents became concerned, and I ended up taking growth hormone to get a little bit taller.
And can you talk about why, and not just your parents, but a lot of people might think about height that way, like, oh no, we don't want our kid to turn out too short. There seems historically, I think it's no secret, to be a bias toward taller being better. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, there's, I mean, definitely an assumption that it sucks to be short, you know. And I mean, I think back to when my parents, you know, took me to the endocrinologist, like things were pretty great in my life besides being short. I had friends. I wasn't complaining about it. It was the fear itself of like a short child that had them take me to the doctor. So, I mean, you know, I tried to look for the origin of this bias, and there's like a lot of possible reasons behind it. But there's that one evolutionary reason is that we were kind of like, we evolved to think that tall was better because, you know, a taller person could protect their family, be more likely to hunt and get food for their family. So to this day, we continue to think that tall is better.
And the
but when you look at, yeah. Sorry,
yeah, the bulk of your essay suggests that, well, in 2023, those rules may no longer apply. Why not?
Because we don't have to go hunt for food anymore. You know, the people bring home the food, the people sitting in the chair. And so like my 5'6" husband, you know, I joke that maybe we'll evolve to like appreciate a partner who can sit in a chair for 8 hours without getting up to pee or evolve out of the need to blink, you know, as you're looking at your computer screen. But so far we have not caught up with that in our brains because it takes millions of years.
Do you still see, I'm guessing, some of that built-in bias, whether jokingly or not, where people, you know, have expressed that preference for tall over short?
All the time. It's in our language. It's, you know, you even see it when someone will take like a picture and then they'll look at the camera and they'll be like at the photo and they'll be like, oh my God, I look so tall in this one. You know, they're excited about it. It's in our language, like statuesque, a tall drink of water. It's, you know, what people set their dating minimums to online. You know, there was this person that wrote in a letter to the editor, and she said that like her sons are short. And one time one of the kids in class came up to her and said, I'm the tallest in class. And she said, you know what? There's nothing wrong with that. And that just shows that, like, you know, it was a tweak in language, and it's like something that you don't usually hear. Usually that's like something that you would congratulate someone for.
You mentioned that your husband is also on the shorter side of average, and you touch on this in your piece. There's this, people call it, I think, Napoleon syndrome or something, the attribution of sort of an angry chip on the shoulder personality,
right,
toward shorter men in particular. You say in your own family and in research, that's not really how it is.
Yeah, I mean, it's more that, you know, there is a compensation for it, and it can show up in many ways. But another way it can show up is like in a pro-social way, in a way that benefits them. That's like developing humor or being really kind. You know, it's another way to get the attention that you're not getting because you don't automatically get it because you're tall or have that social preference.
Height discrimination has always seemed weird to me because it's like literally one aspect of ourselves that we had pretty much no control over, right? Like we have there are very few life choices that will make us taller or shorter.
Very true. Yeah.
So what do you say to other people in your own situation who are, you know, shorter than average, who may feel bad about it, who may have, I guess, internalized that attitude towards shortness?
I mean, writing this essay was a big thing that I was trying to do to show that there are really good things about being short. And I think that's like a step towards fighting the bias a bit. I mean, I thought it was interesting that I got a lot of hate mail from tall people. Like I felt like they would be very secure in their situation of you know, being preferred. And I think that they felt like their privilege was a little bit, you know, at risk of weakening.
And in your piece, you lay out some just like modern day practical advantages of being shorter. What are some of the things you see in your own life?
Practical is that you have, you know, shorter people live longer, have less incidence of cancer. You know, you can get your way through a crowd pretty easy. You have more space on an airplane. You know, the only thing I could think of that I can't do that tall people can is like reach really high things. And you can get a ladder from that, and pretty tell people are pretty kind, usually at the grocery store, you know, they want to help out. Feel like those limbs are worth something these days that they can't go hunting and stuff.
As we wrap up, Mara, are you just generally hopeful that we can stop judging each other based on height?
I am hopeful. I think it'll be a slow process, but I think what, like, the interest in this article and the subject matter means that it's something that people have really been thinking about, you know? It hits home somehow. It struck a chord.
Mara, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Mara Altman is a writer and author. She wrote a column for the New York Times called There's Never Been a Better Time to Be Short. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a Cuban refugee who lives in Madison. He's also one of the people featured in the new podcast, WPR Reports Uprooted. As a warning, this story contains brief mentions of violence.
Osvaldo Durruti was sitting in a Wisconsin prison in the mid-1990s. He was in his 30s, and he was desperate to get out. He wanted to go home to Cuba, so he concocted a plan.
I had a sad moment.
And this sad moment led to something quite disturbing. In his mind, to get out of prison, Durruti was going to have to kill the most hated man behind bars.
I went little violent, you know, toward, you know, inmates, you know, Jeffrey Dahmer, you know.
Durruti thought he'd get out if he killed Wisconsin's most notorious serial killer, Jeffrey Dahmer. And it almost happened in the prison chapel. But the weapon broke and guards intervened.
But I'm not proud of that. At that moment, you know, my mind was so disturbed. Because when I tried to kill him, the reason I did it because I want to go back to Cuba. I don't want to be here in this country no more. I want to go back to Cuba.
But the assault never got Durruti deported like he hoped. So how did he get here? Durruti settled in Madison, Wisconsin after coming to the United States as part of the Mariel boatlift, a moment in 1980 when 125,000 Cuban exiles were allowed to leave the island. Of that group, almost 15,000 were sent to Fort McCoy in Sparta, Wisconsin, including Durruti. At Fort McCoy, he made friends with a group of musicians who ended up playing for people across the state.
We all got together. We started, you know, playing music. And that was when I ended up going to different places. And that was my way out of the environment, the McCoy, you know.
Once Durruti was out on his own, he settled in Madison. He liked the people, the city, the nightlife. But discrimination and a language barrier made finding a job difficult. So he turned to the drug trade to make easy money. Durruti says he wasn't thinking about the consequences.
We were selling dopes, mm-hmm. You know, we were stealing. We were doing the crazy thing, you know. I can never say regret because, you know, once I do something, I don't look back. If I pay for my mistake, I pay if I do wrong.
He paid for that mistake with a prison sentence, where he would later cross paths with a notorious serial killer. The sentence is also getting in the way of him going back to Cuba. He wants to return to see his family, like his sister, who he hasn't seen in person in more than 40 years.
The first thing I want to do, I want to embrace her and, you know, just raise her up, you know, and hug. Give her the hug that, you know, nobody ever... She never gave the hug from her, you know. She said, what you're going to do is cook for me.
But he can't go back. Even though he's no longer in prison, Durruti has felony convictions, so he can't return to Cuba or become a U.S. citizen.
When I came here, I was wild, and nothing good was on my mind. Now, you know, it's like, I got better understanding what it's like to be an American citizen. And not only that, but putting me behind bars, it was something that I needed because I learned how to become a man.
And now, Durruti just wants a second chance.
We pay for our mistake, you know. We are not a threat to society anymore. We just want, you know, to ask for forgiveness, consideration, opportunity to, you know, grow as a man, as a father. You know, we're not perfect. We just want to, you know, be part of American dream, you know.
To learn more about Osvaldo Durruti's life in Cuba and Wisconsin, check out the podcast WPR Reports Uprooted. All 8 episodes plus historical photos, all at WPR.org/uprooted. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, if you're given the chance to pay in small interest-free installments for that cashmere sweater or whatever you've been looking at, should you take it? An economist breaks down the risks of using these new buy now, pay later financing apps when buying stuff online. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. If you've bought anything online lately, you might have seen the option at checkout to break your purchase down into a few interest-free payments. This lending method is called buy now, pay later. Gotten big in the last few years. The value of buy now, pay later loans from companies like Affirm, Afterpay, and Klarna increased over 1,000% from 2019 to 2021. The idea is you can buy just about anything with buy now, pay later, even something as cheap as a burger from Uber Eats. These buy now, pay later loans sell themselves at 0% interest with minimal penalties for a missed payment. Is all too good to be true, though? Marco DiMaggio is an Ogunlesi Associate Professor of Business Administration. I'm sorry, Ogunlesi Family Associate Professor of Business Administration at Harvard Business School, who's researched these buy now, pay later plans. Marco, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
There's a generational divide, I think, here. This whole thing's going to be under the radar for a lot of people, including, I'll admit, me. Explain what these things are and how they work.
Sure. So during and after COVID, this has become very popular. This is just a different way of making a transaction, mostly online. So rather than imagining buying a shirt, you add it to the shopping cart. And once you are at the checkout, you have different options. You can pay with a credit card, you can pay with PayPal. Nowadays, you can pay in 4 or in multiple installments. And this is a buy now and pay later option. And this is offered by some of the companies you mentioned before, Klarna, Afterpay, and so on and so forth. And this allowed people to basically pay whatever they are buying in multiple installments. Usually, you pay in 4 with 0 interest rate, meaning you put a down payment today, which is 1/4 for your purchase. So if you are buying a shirt for $100, you are paying right now $25. And then 2 weeks from now, they are going to withdraw from your account another $25. And then 2 weeks after, and then 2 weeks after. And finally, after 4 payment, you are done paying for that shirt.
Now, it's different than layaway, right? Because I get the shirt right away. Do I have that right?
Correct.
Okay.
Exactly.
And it's different from credit cards. Why would people use this option instead of, say, or why are people using this option instead of, say, charging it on a credit card?
Yes, so I think that the biggest appeal is because they advertise that this is a zero interest rate option. And this has been particularly appealing for younger folks, probably those that have a tendency to not like credit cards because maybe they've seen their parents get in trouble with using credit cards. And so the idea is that you are going to get exactly the same thing. You are going to get instant liquidity, meaning you get these funds right now. The merchant is happy. You get the good that you are purchasing, and then you have you are committing yourself to repay this loan, because it is a loan, in the next 4 installment. And so that's I think the biggest appeal, the advertising that there is a zero interest rate, and also the fact that it's very easy to get, in the sense that the underwriting of the borrower, so when you quote unquote apply online, that's very easy. It's everything is online and it's instantaneous. And there is basically no pulling of your credit report. So there is no effect on your FICO score. But people should know that most of these companies do report their information to credit bureau, especially the negative information. Mm-hmm. So if you do default on a buy now, pay later product, your FICO score will be affected as if you were defaulting on your credit card.
Now, if I'm a company doing this, I'm fronting you the money for your shirt at 0% interest. How am I making money off of this deal?
So it's the merchant that is paying. So the merchant is paying between 6% and 8% of the purchase of the transaction to the company that is offering this service. And so think about this: the merchant is usually paying about 2% or a little bit more than that for a credit card. right? So every time I use my Amex, the merchant unfortunately is going to pay a transaction fee that is going to go to Amex. Now they are paying a significantly higher transaction fee that is going to go to Klarna and Afterpay. Why are they doing that? Well, they're doing that because these individuals that are using these products are going to buy more than what they would have bought otherwise.
Talking to Marco DiMaggio from the Harvard Business School about the rise of these buy now, pay later apps, programs, credit things. Big now, but some risks, Marco. You wrote in a recent piece in The Atlantic, it might look pretty good for now. What are the downsides you're seeing?
Yes, so we are seeing that a significant fraction of these individuals end up in trouble by using these products. The reason is because there is an automatic withdrawal of your funds from your account, and we observe that these individuals tend to use too much of these loan products, of these buy now and pay later. And what end up happening is that they end up paying either late fees or overdraft fees. And so this would suggest that these individuals sort of overextended themselves by using these additional products. And so ex ante was a great idea. You know, it seems like free money because they don't charge you an interest rate. But there are some people that tend to overuse this and overextend themselves. And so that's pretty problematic, especially because it's not regulated as a loan by any of the agencies. And so it also has less of a regulatory oversight.
I wanted to ask about this. This isn't, I guess, technically a bank. It's not technically a credit card. So is there any kind of regulation of these things?
So I think the only agency that is really looking into this and has started because exactly there have been some complaints is the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. But technically, because there is no interest rate that has been charged, these are not loans. And in fact, you know, a bank might not be very happy about this because they don't have visibility into this type of loans. So think about if Marco goes and starts buying furniture using Buy Now and Pay Later, he might end up in a lot of debt. The issue is that nobody else is going to recognize that Marco indeed is already into debt because they don't report to the credit bureaus. And so the other lenders are not going to have any visibility into this. And so this is even more problematic because then now I can create a hidden risk in the market where neither the regulator nor the other creditors have any visibility into.
Let's talk to, you know, a younger consumer, someone in their low 20s, say, and they're saying, you know, I want to buy stuff online, at least from time to time. Marco, what do you recommend they do or at least think about before making a decision of credit card versus buy now, pay later versus whatever other option?
So I think the aspect that I like about the buy now and pay later is that there is some sort of self-commitment, right? If I know that if I use the credit card, I'm not sure whether I'm going to really repay it at the end of the month, so before being charged for interest rate, then it makes sense to use a buy now and pay later because I will love to do that no matter what, except in the case in which I don't have any money. So that aspect of the commitment and to avoid the interest rate, I like it. The issue is that people might lose track of all the buy now and pay later transaction they have. And so what I suggest is that there needs to be much more attention about how many of these transactions you are making and only make the ones where you know to have the funds for. So don't buy the shirt hoping only with the $25 and that's the only thing that you have in your account. Do it if you already know that you are going to have the full amount and keep track of that. That's the only way in which you can avoid the overdraft, you can avoid insufficient funds, you can avoid them reporting negative information to credit bureaus.
In our last half a minute or so, Marco, do you think these buy now, pay later things are going to get bigger or are they going to hit a wall at some point?
I think they have been very successful for two main factors. One was COVID, so people at home browsing and trying to spend as much as possible, the additional liquidity they got from the government. And the second one is a booming market. Now, with both of these conditions not being true anymore, I think those are becoming more and more of a risky product, both for the consumer as well as for the creditors. We've seen more and more defaults on this.
Marco, we'll leave it there. Thanks for sharing this with us.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
That's Marco DiMaggio, the Ogun Lacy Family Associate Professor of Business Administration at Harvard Business School. He talked to us today about the explosion of these buy now, pay later financing apps in online retail. Have you encountered this? Do you use it? Love to hear from you. Email ideas at WPR.org. That's ideas at WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the Biden administration is making the case for more legal protections for renters. Find out what that could look like and some of the challenges facing people who rent their housing these days. And a Senate committee is digging into the business practices of Ticketmaster, the event ticket and booking giant, after a Taylor Swift fiasco and decades of criticism of their business model. Check out the history behind that story and what could come next. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we look at competing priorities for expanding public education funding and expanding school choice in Wisconsin after Governor Evers outlined his education goals in his State of the State address last night. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.